for listening to Off the Hook.
A very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. I'm sorry nobody answered the phone before. I really thought somebody was going to pick up. We went back in time, and we were trying a thing. It didn't work. We'll figure it out. This is Emmanuel. I'm here for this hour. Kyle's over there.
Hi.
How you doing? Over in Skype land, we have, hang on, I know this, Rob. Is that you, Rob?
Good evening. It is indeed me.
It's been such a long time since we've been on the air. That's why I'm having trouble recognizing. And whoa, is that Gila over there on the other side?
Good evening.
Hello. How you doing? And that must be Alex, right?
It is I.
Okay, I got all the names right, folks. We've been super busy. All kinds of things going on. Life keeps getting in the way, and there's no alternative, but we're glad to be back. We've got all your cards and letters and emails and things like that, and we have a lot to talk about, a lot, as always, in the world of high technology, low intelligence, and whatever else is out there. Can I start by complaining? I mean, I'm told I don't do that enough, and I need to get better at it. But I do have something to complain about. I've actually complained about this already on the social media network, so if you're a fan of those, you might already be familiar with this particular issue of mine. Okay with you guys?
Go for it.
Okay. There's this service out there on the television called Netflix. You may have heard about it. There's a button on my remote on my television set that says Netflix. If I push that button, my television set goes to Netflix, right? It's something that other people have, a Netflix button that immediately takes you to a Netflix screen. And you log in, or you're already logged in, and you can view Netflix fare. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I hit that button, and much to my surprise, I got a message on my television set saying, "This device is no longer supported. To watch instantly, please see the list of supported devices on our website." I was fit to be tied. Here it is. I'm looking at a television set, and the screen on the TV is telling me that my television is no longer supported. Now, can you imagine if you turned on a television set in the past and you tuned to Channel 2 or something, and Channel 2 said, "No, your TV's no good anymore. You have to go get a new TV in order to watch Channel 2. Why, there'd be riots in the street. There'd be insurrections. There'd be all kinds of things going on. People would not tolerate it. Yet today, for some reason, this is considered normal, where a service that you pay for is basically unavailable to you if you don't continue to buy new hardware. So I said some things about this on the internet, and the response was not surprising. And the reason I say that is because no matter what, if you complain about something involving technology, there are always people who will stand up for the bad technology. Okay, let's read a couple of these. Your TV was never supported by Netflix. It just happened to have a Netflix client, which worked for an earlier version of their service and hasn't been updated since because your TV vendor kept its firmware. Okay, how does that help me exactly? So I'm supposed to be mad at my TV now instead of Netflix? I just want to watch a damn TV show, and I have to jump through hoops. That's not right. The next response was, life offline is great. Okay, great. So I need a lecture now on not watching television after complaining about something that I spent a lot of money on no longer working. So now you're telling me that, yeah, you're stupid to be watching TV. Why don't you go outside? First of all, it's 2 in the morning when I'm trying to do this, all right? And I'm not going to go outside. And then, okay, response number 3. People still use Netflix? Oh, yeah, now I'm an old grandpa for, like, wanting to use Netflix. Yeah, I'm not cool anymore. I've yet to see a positive response, something that doesn't blame the end user. And, yeah, I'm an end user at times. I'm proud to be an end user. Here's a suggestion. Why not just buy a NUC, N-U-C, or something, and run it that way? Then you'd have the added benefit of having an actual computer connected to your TV. Maybe I don't want a computer connected to my TV. Maybe I just want a damn TV set. You know, maybe I just want to do things the way they're supposed to work. I have a Netflix button on my remote. That, to me, is an implied contract right there. And I'm sure, Alex, you'd stand next to me in court and swear to that. That, you know, having that on the remote is my promise to be able to watch Netflix by pushing that button instead of getting a scolding. Okay, if the TV is that old, my TV is less than 10 years old. You know what? I grew up in Queens. And in my entire life in Queens, we had the same TV set. This huge black and white, I think it was a Sylvania or something. And we would never think of getting another television set. It was the only one. Occasionally it had to get fixed. That was a big deal. But, yeah, things are meant to last. And I like to hold on to things. I like to hold on to technology. I'm using a laptop right now that, how old is this laptop, Kyle? Well, how old do you say this one is?
It's like 10, almost 10 or 12 years.
I think it's 12 years. I think it's, yeah. Yeah, and it still works. It does everything I want to do. You know, I'm not composing symphonies on it. I'm not doing, although I probably could if I had any musical talent. But people are too quick to throw out technology and just follow the instructions all the time about upgrades and what becomes no longer relevant, no longer supported. So if your TV is that old, it's 1080p at most, so any streaming stick or device should work. Okay, fine. They're telling me to go use an iPhone or an iPad, which I don't have, other services. Okay, great. You know, I can do all this. I know I can do all this. The point is, I shouldn't have to do all this. It should still work. Why is my TV all of a sudden not supported? Because somebody made a programming decision someplace, and everybody is expected to follow it. Here's probably the most helpful response that I got out of all these responses, and there were many, many more I'm skipping over. This is why I want a dumb TV. It's not an insult. It's a thing. A dumb TV. A TV should only be a display. Maybe also a speaker, nothing else. Any smarts need to be in an attached device that can be replaced or upgraded if outdated. Amen to that. Yeah, absolutely. There are more. In the end, yeah, I figured it out. I didn't have to throw out my TV. I used a Roku device. But again, how many people out there instantly are able to do that, able to figure it out? They buy a TV, the salesman says, yes, you can get Netflix, there's a Netflix button, and all of a sudden your TV is outdated, you have to get a new TV, and a lot of people, I'll bet, do that. Any thoughts from out there in Skype land? Dila, I know you had your hand up first.
I did. Well, first I was curious what a NUC was, but Rob walked me through that. But, no, it made me think about something. So there was a TV, bought it in 2015, and it has a cute little remote with the buttons on it. And this particular that I'm holding in my hand right now has a Netflix button an Amazon button, a Voodoo button, and an RDO button. And I'm curious now what would happen, because some of these services don't exist anymore.
Don't press that button, Gila. Don't press buttons of services that don't exist.
That sounds like an old Roku.
You'll void your warranty. The TV might even explode. We don't know.
And then we have the newer, got some extra ones. And this one has an HBO Max button, and I wonder if you push the HBO Max button, will it tell you, that's not my name anymore?
That's right. It's called just Max now, isn't it?
Right. So, you know, part of me wonders why we have these services on the buttons, and you can't just program your own buttons. You know, a bunch of services here and here that we don't have, buttons that are just taking up space.
Yeah, program your own buttons. I like that idea.
Yeah, you should be able to, like, remap them to something that works or a workaround that you've devised.
Alex, go ahead.
You should look at the buttons and perhaps see them for what they are. I mean, they're essentially advertisements. They're advertising an online service, and they're utilizing space in your house to do so. So, I mean, I'm not a big fan of these buttons to begin with. I like Gila's idea of programmable buttons, or maybe, you know, something is crazy like, if I hold in the number one on the keypad, it'll open Netflix, and then you can program number two to open Max, and number three to open Crossy Road. Like, that's not something I think that would be, you know, beyond the realm of technical possibility. But my question to you, Emmanuel, is the button itself not working only, or is it the case that you just can't access Netflix by navigating to the app and opening the app some other way?
No, obviously the button is working because it's generating the message on the screen. What they've done is they've simply changed the requirements so that, as some of these people said, your old TV is no longer supported. So
right.
It just means get a new TV and stop holding on to old technology, which works fine in any other way.
Can you access Netflix by any other method outside the button?
Yeah, so what I wound up doing was using a Roku device and simply going to the Netflix app on that. It worked just fine. There's no reason for that to happen other than the fact that they can do it, and a lot of people will be mystified.
I think you should just relabel the button with like a label maker and just call it anger.
Well,
and then whenever you get yourself angry, just push that button.
We do have a label maker here. Kyle's the official labeler, and maybe we'll do that. But again, you know, I like the idea of programmable buttons, you know, where you can make the button do different things. We don't have enough of that. Go ahead, Rob.
So the point someone made about just wanting to get a dumb TV is something I find very interesting nowadays, because the way the TV business works now, the manufacturers basically get the... When you buy a television that is designated a television in the store, you'll find it comes with a bunch of apps preloaded on it, and that is because the price of the television is subsidized by companies like Netflix and Amazon Prime and Max and whatever else to put their apps on the device. So it's in front of your eyes right when you start up your new television. And so those companies pay the TV manufacturer, and the TV manufacturer passes, I guess, some of the savings along. But also, they want their own sort of rent-seeking behavior and your membership and things like Roku and so on and so on. So they want to keep making money off of you in any way they can. You can buy a dumb TV, but it's not called that. It's known as a commercial display. And if you start looking for those, you'll realize that they cost a lot more, like significant amounts of money more than if you walked into a store to buy a television, even if they're the same size, even if they have the same, you know, brightness, sound, whatever, the same amount of inputs, because they charge you more to not have the pre-advertised garbage put in front of you. And that also gives the people who make the pre-advertised garbage, such as the Netflix app, power over how their software works with the device once you've got it up and running.
I think there's also like a symbiotic return for those service providers because they have they then capture that subscribership, and that actually in turn motivates people to buy more hardware. If a TV fails, they're going to want their services back or get back onto those the way they did on the previous bit of hardware. So that relationship works back and forth. to keep people buying hardware, whether it's just sort of like a mechanical failure in the power supply or in some component, or the entire software end of it becomes unwieldy for the manufacturer. And their cycles are much less than, like, even a year when they're introducing new TVs. And I also think, like, the way we're doing production now is incredibly high resolution with digital cinema, and the affordability and the ability to make a lot of programming at that level of picture quality. And a lot of people have larger and larger resolution devices to consume that content on. And I think that also drives the unwieldy bits of, drives the manufacturer and the service providers away from supporting legacy operating systems that are connected to TVs that are HD, which itself is still a valid and really good-looking format, but the sending of, like, very, very high-resolution new programming to down-convert or otherwise provide versions that are of lower resolution or down-converted for those legacy TVs could become unwieldy and is also beyond, like, what the manufacturer is doing as far as the OS is concerned. The actual service provider has to compensate for doing sort of lower res copies of each of these new programs, which it takes a little bit of infrastructure to accommodate and sense that on these different things. I don't know if that makes sense to anyone.
Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, but in the meantime, there was a great post that went around Mastodon a few days ago where somebody posted a photo of an old portable radio and said, "This is something my father-in-law had. It was never opened. It was from 48 years ago, a GE radio in his garage. And no pairing, no logins, no setup. It just works." You can listen to us right now with a radio you bought 50 years ago.
Well, not if it's an AM radio. It might be an AM radio only, so he should check that. But
does
not
the picture is FM.
Not the case. Okay, not the case with television. Because that was the magic of television in days of old, where you could turn on a TV set and it would just work. But now, you know, since we switched to digital, all those frequencies, all those old TVs no longer work without conversion. And the signals aren't nearly as good. You know, when I was a kid, I was able to pick up distant signals on hot summer days for some reason. And I picked up stations in Kentucky, as far away as Kansas at one point, from right here in New York. And there was a certain magic to that. You can still do that on AM radio. Despite the fact that the car manufacturers are trying to get rid of AM radio, you can still do that and experience that magic of hearing a distant place. But today, you're just surrounded by just what I call technological blindness, where, yeah, something is cool. It's a good innovation, but you're giving up something else and not thinking about what you're really giving up when you do that. Go ahead, Gila.
The thing that I was thinking about was in terms of display terminal, right? I was thinking about the difference between being in the Windows and Microsoft ecosystem versus, you know, kind of rolling your own in that way. And what it would take now to create your own home ecosystem for a TV that you didn't immediately plug into the wall and download 3 apps and you're good to go. Like, I cannot imagine the kind of labor and setup it would take to have the kind of setup that we have on our home TV now
mm-hmm.
without those automatic handholds. And I wonder what we're losing by having those plug-and-play systems ready to go without – it's not even a lack of curiosity that we have anymore, but a lack of necessity. You know, you can have 800 apps on your TV in a matter of moments – without even thinking about it, and not having to have an internet connection on your television necessarily, but, as Manuel is just saying, because of the global system of over-the-air not being what it used to be, you know, what can we do for ourselves anymore? Where is that, the DIY ethos of television, man, where's it at?
I think also something I'm thinking about is the analytics side, like what information they're trying to glean from these apps, and that maybe newer, faster displays that can run more apps or the newer software have greater abilities for them to get sort of behavioral and other information about how you use different service providers that are on that embedded OS. It's all very, it's something that's just a moving target. It's just constantly new features and new services are being thrown at the consumers.
I love new features and new services and things like that, but I also love simplicity. I want to be able, and I really should get an over-the-air antenna for digital TV, because there are all kinds of hidden stations that you can find there. Unfortunately, you can't get long-distance reception occasionally. It's either you get it or you don't, and the signal strength is less than it was in the past. But there is still a degree of magic there, and I urge people to explore as much as possible. And speaking of the magic of radio, that's what we broadcast on right now. That's why we want to continue broadcasting over FM radio, not just over the Internet. Yeah, the Internet is great, and that's how we reach the entire world. But radio is the true magic, because right now, guarantee at some point, somebody in New York City is driving right now. Yeah, I'm talking to you, and you're hearing us, and you don't know who we are. You've never heard us before. You just tuned to 99.5 FM, and there are these voices talking on the radio about something that you're mildly interested in, or maybe even more interested in. Well, that's the magic of radio, that you don't know who's out there, that you don't know how many people really are listening, that you don't know what lives you could be affecting, that you don't know what station you'll happen upon next if you just keep tuning the FM dial. When Kyle and I went to Texas not too long ago, we did that a lot. We tuned the dial a lot and heard all kinds of interesting radio stations. And I always suggest people do that rather than just, you know, listen to their mixtape or whatever. Listen to what's local. And here in New York City, WBAI, we're real local. And we've been local since 1960. I'm saying local, not loco. Since 1960. Yeah, people laughing. So the reason we stay on the air is because of listeners like you. Yeah. And all you have to do is call 212-209-2950 and pledge support. And you can be a part of this amazing family, a family that has existed now for over 60 years. Wow. That is something. A family of, you know, people coming and going, obviously, but it's magical programming. If you listen to what goes on over the airwaves here at WBAI, you will hear such a variety. You will hear things that inspire you. You will hear things that outrage you. You will hear things that you never thought of before. Right now, though, we're asking you to give a call to 212-209-2950 and pledge whatever you can to keep this non-commercial radio station going. Yeah, non-commercial. Maybe we didn't mention that. We're a non-commercial radio station, which means we can say things like, boy, Netflix is terrible, because they don't sponsor us, because, you know, we can insult them. We can insult anybody, really, because we're not beholden to anyone but the listeners. Now, for a pledge of $150 or more, we'll send you a thank you gift of the Off the Hook anthology, which consists of every program that we have done since 1988 up until the end of 2023 in MP3 format on a flash drive. That's for everybody who pledges $150 or more. It's called the Off the Hook Anthology. The most important thing, though, is to keep WBAI broadcasting for another 60 years, and hopefully over an FM band that is not messed up by advances in technology that will make it hard or impossible for somebody to just turn on the radio and hear a voice they never heard before, or turn on a radio and hear a voice they're expecting to hear. You know, that is something that I think we all grew up with. It's just that magic of radio, whether it's in our houses or whether it's in our cars. Increasingly now, what I read is that most people listen in their cars, and most people in cars do listen to the radio at some point. I'm not sure how many people still have radios in their houses. Do any of you guys have a radio that you turn on occasionally and say, oh, you know what, I'm going to listen to the radio tonight in my den? Does that still happen, Gila?
I have a clock radio with a CD player in it. It's an absolute unit. I've been schlepping it around for 20 years. And it's fascinating. There have been times when I've checked us on the air from our bedroom. And, no, it's amazing. I love tuning it. And occasionally when I hit the snooze button in the morning, I hit the tuning knob instead. And then the sound is off, which is great.
Uh-huh. So you use it every day. So the radio wakes you up every day.
Yeah, and sometimes when the tuner is off, fuzz wakes me up every day, which is not a great start to the morning.
Okay, all right. Wow.
Okie doke.
That's I forgot about clock radios. Yeah, that's still a thing. So I hope people do use radios in their homes more, because some of my fondest memories are listening to, well, first AM radio, because I didn't have an FM radio at first, and then FM, and just exploring, knowing every station in the area, knowing a little bit about the history. Go ahead, Alex.
I remember finding this station when I was out on Long Island, and I would listen to the radio on a Walkman that was also a radio, but the cord for the headphones was acting as the antenna.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to get WBAI, I had to string the headphone cord up, like, around my bedpost. I remember it being quite a production. But I got it in, and I could listen to this particular show. This was the show that I wanted to find. And it felt like some kind of revelation. It felt like I was listening in on these wise gurus from the hacking community, you know, that were imparting knowledge to little old me over in Suffolk County. And it was pretty cool. It was really magical. And I think that we got to encourage that type of thing again. I mean, this is just, I think, part and parcel of exploring and playing around with technology. And people forget that radio itself really is quite a dark art. You know, this is why the Flipper Zero is banned in Canada. You know, it allows you to play with radio frequencies. It's also why intelligence agencies continue to use shortwave radio to communicate with operatives in the field. I mean, radio is something that does not require any kind of acknowledgement of receipt of the information. That's really, I think, extraordinarily unique and special in today's era, when everything is allowed.
When you consider it, when you listen online, you may feel anonymous, but there is a log of you somewhere. Whether the broadcasting entity is keeping track, they can see your IP address. They can see where you're coming from. They can count how many people are actually listening at any time. Can't do that on broadcasts over the radio waves. And I think, you know, that might drive some control freaks crazy, because they can't charge people a certain ad rate based on hypothetical numbers. But it also adds to that magic we're talking about. And that's what we're asking you to help preserve, because, yes, WBAI is online, but WBAI is also broadcasting off of a very tall building in Times Square to the tri-state area, and that alone is a miracle. Now, for pledges of $25 or more, you get to vote in the WBAI elections and Pacifica elections and all that fun stuff. You get to have a voice in decisions that are made, and that is something that I think is extremely important, and that's why we're asking for your support. Now, if you're hearing this at a time when you prefer to go to a website instead of calling 212-209-2950, you can go to the website givetowbai.org, and on there, there's everything you need to know about how to pledge, and thank you gifts and all that kind of thing. It's all right there for you. Again, givetowbai.org, phone number 212-209-2950. And we want to thank our listeners who have really responded well to all of this over the past few weeks. Yes, there are a number of crises. There are always crises here of one sort or another. But we do keep the content coming out. And that is what is most important. And it's your support that makes that possible. And so many people have called in or gone to the website and pledged in the name of Off the Hook. And that just it inspires us. It inspires us to keep going and keep doing the things we do. We have some letters. You can write to us. We've got the email address at the end of the program. This is to Off the Hook. I'm a WBAI sustaining listener. Thank you very much. I've been listening to your show for several years. Have learned a lot about technology in particular. For safety and security, I need to find a VPN provider that is lower cost yet effective at hiding or changing my IP address online so my activity is encrypted. Do you have a recent archive program where you list your VPN recommendations? Signed, Ms. Robinson. Well, Ms. Robinson, we're not going to recommend one company over another, and I don't really know anything about pricing, but the concept of a VPN allows you, well, it allowed me to watch Eurovision a couple of weeks ago by pretending I was in Denmark, seeing a four-hour competition without a single commercial, just like people in Denmark got to do. Things like that, that you're not allowed to do in your geographical area for no reason other than the fact that certain powerful people say you're not allowed to do that. That's what a VPN can do for you. A VPN can also mask your whereabouts if you're doing something sensitive. And that does not make you a criminal. That makes you smart. That makes you somebody who, oh wow, I just sounded like Trump for a second, didn't I? No, I didn't mean it like that. I mean, you know, tech savvy, knowing that you don't have to always come from your home address. You can manipulate the technology and come from a different address. And there are many reasons why you might want to do that. Now, there are all kinds of VPN companies out there. Again, I'm not going to list the companies, but if you do a search online, just search for VPN. You can do VPN cheap. I don't know who that is. That's not me. I don't think that's me because I closed the program that made that noise. Is it one of you guys? Alex, is it you? No? All right, we're going to track down that noise, whatever it is. Yeah, that's my thoughts on VPN. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, one thing for anybody who is not familiar, just to really quickly give the Cliff Notes version of an explanation, a VPN is a service where instead of connecting directly to the things you look at over the Internet, they will sit in between that connection as an intermediary. So everything you do gets bounced through this external server somewhere, and the operators of the sites and things that you visit will only see the address of that external server and not your own IP address. But one thing that I find very interesting is that the concept of VPNs, especially within the past few years, has become kind of mainstream to the point where there is a lot of help out there. If you do some searches to not only find one, choose one, but also set it up, maintain it, and so on, there are ads for VPN companies on the subway now. And we're at that level of the general public kind of starting to understand how this is useful, how it can be an important part of your digital life. And I've seen on forums and things about things entirely non-technical, but somebody wants to accomplish something and realize, oh, yeah, I just used a VPN. It's really out there, and it's really an interesting thing to read about, get into if you're not into already.
Go ahead, Alex.
One thing I would add to this, too, is you want to consider what the purpose is of the VPN that you intend to use. If you simply want to remain anonymous, there are a lot of VPNs out there that don't have logging, that advertise they don't have logging. I will tell you this, I think a lot of them have more logs than they let on, but at least you would want one that would be very privacy conscious. On the other hand, if you want to use a VPN to get around censorship, let's say, or access a service from a geographical area that is otherwise geofenced, then you would want to make sure that you're looking for a VPN that would probably have something called a dedicated IP address in the country from which you want to appear that your traffic is originating. So, for instance, if I wanted to access, let's say, Netflix in Belgium, you would want to have a Belgian IP address. And a lot of services, a lot of VPN services will offer you a dedicated IP address in other countries where they have servers for relatively cheap, for really just a few dollars a month. And that becomes really handy if you want to access things like the BBC while you're not in the UK. It can also unlock a whole bunch of programs for your existing services. So, for instance, if that Netflix button that Emmanuel was complaining about earlier in the program actually had worked, and he was connected to a VPN that made it appear as if his traffic was originating from London, he would get a lot of different selections on Netflix that aren't available in the United States. You know, he'd get to watch things like In the Loop and Peep Show. And, you know, what is also really weird, too, is it's weirdly hard to stream The Office, the American version of The Office, in the United States these days, but it seems like the entirety of it is streaming from the UK. So you get, you know, all these other different tips and tricks that you can do with VPNs as well. They're fun things to play with.
Yeah, for a lot better than just looking at old episodes of The Office. There are all kinds of things that you can do. And it's on Comedy Central all the time, Alex, so it's not hard to find.
Well, I watch TV.
But, for the folks, geofencing, that's basically what we're talking about. That's where you're restricted from doing something simply because you're in a particular place, correct?
Yeah, if a site only wants people from a certain part of the world to be able to see it, wants people from another part of the world to not be able to see it, you can use a VPN to trick this site into thinking that you're in the part of the world they feel is okay.
Now, people are going to ask this, so we might as well answer it now. What's the difference between what we're talking about and something like Tor?
Tor is kind of a crapshoot because it is decentralized. It more decentralized than a VPN, which is all one service that you're bouncing everything through. But Tor also, you can't really control where the other side of the connection comes out because it's random by its nature. And it's re-randomized every time you start it up. So you can't really go through Tor and say, I want to be coming from this part of the world or that part of the world in a dependable manner as easily as you can with a VPN. Also, Tor's not responsible for such things. Alex, you have something.
Yeah, I think the other distinction is that Tor, known as the onion router, right? You know, you think about the image of the onion. It has lots of layers. That's what onions are known for. We always talk about peeling back the layers of the onions. And when you're using the Tor router, your traffic is going to take lots of different stops. It's not going to just go through one other network and then pop out somewhere else. It's going to go, let's say, to Liberia, then into Bangkok, then it'll pop over to Istanbul, then it'll go back into St. Petersburg, then to Belgium, and then come out the other side in New York. I mean, who knows, right? But it's also Tor is generally a lot slower than using a VPN for that reason.
Yeah, and while VPN services might be optimized for things like watching high bandwidth video or, you know, playing data intensive games or anything else that might take a large chunk of a connection, if you're doing that sort of thing over Tor, it tends to be seen as sort of abusing the network because people are trying to use it for smaller text-based things, and so it's not really encouraged to use Tor for that sort of purpose.
Oh, I just wanted to reiterate, I mean, the thoughts Rob expressed were like spot on as far as I was concerned, just as far as the acceptability, like the idea of ads for tunneling software in subway tunnels, it's pretty funny. But the VPN acronym, for those who don't know, is a virtual private network, is the definition of that term. And these service providers are using what is a protocol that you can develop and run your own system outside of all of these as well, which is worth mentioning. Perhaps a little bit more work is needed to build that yourself, but it is meant for all kinds of businesses and personal uses as a part of the IP protocol that we use all the time. So it has been established and used for quite some time, but it is much more geared towards creating a full network connection versus all of the layers in what I also know is termed a hidden service. So Tor requires special software that's looking for this particular domain, dot onion addressing and the like. So there's distinctions, and yeah, a higher bandwidth traffic is a little bit harder, and it can be spotty because the network is decentralized and changing. It's sort of amorphous.
Well, you can get more information on Tor by going to torproject.org, S-T-O-R-project.org. I should also point out that both with Tor and certain VPNs, sites like Google try and block them because they don't approve. They don't approve of us taking control of the technology. In fact, good luck trying to access YouTube using a Tor browser. It's almost impossible sometimes. That's the kind of opposition that we tend to run into when we try and change the technology a little bit. Go ahead, Kyle.
Another thing I would mention is getting around geofencing is one use, but if your activities, if whatever it is you're doing online is disallowed, say, in one place, but you're testing some network elsewhere. VPNs are used for this as well,
mm-hmm.
Sort of jurisdictional hopping with whatever work you're doing versus where that work is originating from. That's all true. I want to say about that.
We have another letter. We get multiple letters. Look how much time we spent on that one. Hey, I don't really know who else to discuss this with, but here goes. I can't tell you how many letters begin that way. I have a French cell subscription, and I'm using it roaming in Switzerland because it's so much cheaper than a Swiss plan. It's ridiculous, but that's another topic. Yeah, Switzerland is extremely expensive. So I have this number from my health insurance I can call to speak to a doctor, and I called it with my French line while roaming. Every time the call is answered, I get this recording of a random conversation between a few seemingly U.S. English speakers. It's always the same conversation. That is, when redialing the number, it starts off at the same point, plays the same audio, and it drops the call after a variable amount of time. If I call that same number with a Swiss cell line, then I get the right service, my health insurance's doctor, and not the random conversation. I'm completely puzzled by this. I don't know anyone who is into freaking or knows anything about telephone systems, but I thought you guys might be able to appreciate the weirdness of it and maybe even figure out what's going on. And who are these people on the recording? Where was it made? How long ago? Why am I hearing it? I have a video recording of it on speakerphone and the number I'm calling. It's rather large, so I'm not emailing it. I'd love to figure this out. Let me know if this something you're curious to talk about more from Pierre. Well, Pierre, first thing I think you should do is make an audio recording of this, not a video recording. There are sites where you can upload your video and turn it into audio if you don't have the software to do that yourself. And then send that to us so we can hear it. You say it's a random conversation, but then you say it's always the same conversation. So I'm a little confused. Is it always the same phrases being said? And what are those phrases? We can help figure out what this is and why it could be some kind of telephone company recording or something weird. Or maybe it's a recording that's supposed to play from the phone company and somebody somehow wrote over it with something else. I don't know. It's a bizarre scenario, but It's certainly possible. This sounds very bizarre, but I'm curious. I'd like to know more. How about you guys?
I am so curious about this. It has been a long time, and I'm an old phone freak, and it has been a very long time since I've been able to be presented with some sort of glitch in routing like this, and I've never heard of something like this happening, just routing a call different ways depending on where it's coming from.
But I think we've all, those of us who lived in the 90s and further back, we all can remember crossed lines, right? We pick up the phone and all of a sudden you're talking to somebody you didn't call, right? Has anybody not experienced that in our group? We all have? I can't tell.
Yeah,
have. Okay. Well, it doesn't happen much anymore, if at all. I don't know. I remember back, I grew up in a what's known as number 5 crossbar switch. There were periods of time, I don't know what caused this, maybe a well-informed listener out there can tell us, but sometimes you would pick up the phone, and instead of a dial tone, you'd immediately get connected to somebody else. Now, when this happened, it happened a lot. In other words, it wouldn't happen for weeks, and all of a sudden, it would start happening almost every time you picked up the phone. It was so much fun that my friends and I would immediately contact each other saying, it's happening again. And when it was happening, we could get away with all kinds of mischief. I was at the Stony Brook campus, and I would be constantly picking up the phone, being connected to people. I convinced people there was a curfew going on and that they were not to leave their dormitories. And they believed me, and they spread the word. It wasn't hard to do this. But there's all kinds of other – you meet all sorts of people. One fun thing that we did was we talked to the person who had just picked up the phone on their end, asking them what they intended to do. Why did you just pick up your phone? And they said, well, I was going to call this person. I said, well, we have to make sure – we have to manually place phone calls now. That's required by law. So tell us the number you're calling. And we'll let them know to expect your call. And that's exactly what we did. We would call them and say, you're going to get a call from this person. And they would be just as mystified as everybody else. All kinds of fun that you used to be able to have that I don't think people are having anymore. I'd love to hear about other adventures, though, other things that people are having fun with phone networks.
Absolutely. And the more I think about this, the more I'm wondering if it is, if not itself, an error message at the phone company, at some phone company in between A and B, but maybe routing to where there should be some kind of error message and isn't anymore because not a lot of those aren't used anymore. Some just kind of weirdness along the way like that. Or they're just calling someone's weirdly set up answering machine.
Well, so, I want to hear that recording. I really do. I definitely want to hear that. Hey, we have only a couple minutes left, but I wanted to read a crazy story because there's always crazy stories in the news. A photographer has sued a woman who posted an image of her grandmother's apartment that featured wallpaper that apparently he designed. Okay, what happened here was that the grandmother moved out of her apartment. She's no longer able to live there. She moved in with her granddaughter, and so that she could maintain the cost of caring for her grandmother, the granddaughter took over the apartment and rented it out as a vacation property. She advertised the apartment on a rental website, and it included photos of the property on the listing. 8 years later, the granddaughter received a warning letter for copyright infringement from a Canadian company because she had posted an image of a room in her grandmother's apartment that featured this guy Bohm's photo-based wallpaper. Stefan Bohm, his photo was spotted listing photos for the apartment. And according to a report by the German news publication Heise.de, the photographer is now suing the granddaughter in Cologne Regional Court in Cologne, Germany. In the lawsuit, Bohm alleges that while he may have authorized the printing of his photo on the wallpaper, he did not authorize the reproduction of the photo on the wall in the image posted by the landlady on the vacation property rental website. Oh, my God. Have we all lost our damn minds? So somebody shows a picture of a room, and this guy actually has the audacity to sue them for copyright infringement. He claims the making available of the photo of the wall is an infringement of copyright law. He's also alleging the grandmother infringed his moral rights because she did not find out that he was the photographer behind the wallpaper and did not credit him on the property rental website. I credit this guy with being a first class... Well, I can't say that. Alex, you're our resident lawyer here. Stand up for your profession. Yeah.
This sounds really idiotic on so many ways and so many levels here. Emmanuel, is it the case that the woman who took the photo was actually sued, or that they just received some kind of cease and desist letter? It sounds like they just received a threatening letter.
Well, my understanding is she was in Canada, and this is all happening in Germany. But, mm-hmm. You know, these days, you know, you send a letter like that to somebody, it can scare them. Absolutely.
Yeah, well, it absolutely can. And it's an abuse of, I think, the legal process for doing that, too. I mean, there is this concept of, you know, de minimis non curat lex, right, where the law doesn't care for trifles. You're not necessarily going to have damages, I think, from this type of infringement. The other thing about this is it seems like this might have been born out of some overly aggressive or zealous copyright protection third-party service. That's what it sounds like to me, that maybe this photographer who originally owned the copyright to this particular wallpaper is using some third-party service to identify infringements online.
We're going to have to continue this conversation over on YouTube and overtime. YouTube.com/channel2600 to continue at 8 o'clock over there. Gila, did you have a closing thought on this?
I did, but I'm going to save it for overtime.
Okay. That's going to just about do it for us here tonight. I want to thank everybody for listening. You can write to us, oth@2600.com. And please remember to support WBAI, 212-209-2950. And give to WBAI.org. We'll be back here next week and on Overtime, youtube.com/channel2600. We'll see you there. Good night.
The loudspeaker spoke up and said, the loudspeaker spoke up and said, the loudspeaker spoke up and said,
As usual, and avoid panic buying.
Usually, the left would focus on the conditions under which people make choices, how power creates those conditions. But apparently, that approach isn't relevant when men's sexual pleasure is at stake.
Robert Jensen, quoting from his current article in Counterpunch magazine, Radical Feminism and the Failures of the Left. In it, he takes the left to task for refusing to apply its anti-capitalist critique of how systems of power work to the oppression of women. Professor Jensen will be our guest on Joy of Resistance this Thursday between 11 a.m. and noon, and will take your phone calls. That's Thursday, May 30th, 11 a.m., Joy of Resistance, where we put the left and feminism back together again.
Religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence.